the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you today live from Nashville, Tennessee. We are here at the studio for Salem here in Nashville, and Richard Land live for Faith and Family. It's good to be here. It's always good to be here in Nashville, but it's great to be talking with you across the nation today on the Albert Mohler Program. And let me tell you what we're going to be talking about. No doubt you've heard a good deal of the conversation about Tiger Woods' confession. The statement was made on Friday. We talked about it just a bit on this program on that day. But in the intervening days, there's been a fascinating cultural conversation in this country about the meaning of Tiger Woods' words, and in particular, a focus on the Buddhist aspect. Today, Stephen Prothero in USA Today describes this as America's Buddhist moment. And there are others, whether it's Lisa Miller at Newsweek, or perhaps what you've been hearing and reading in the media yourself, who are raising issues about what this means. Let me tell you, it is a golden opportunity to come to understand the distinction, a very important distinction in worldview between Christianity and Buddhism. And there's a lot going on with this. We're going to be unpacking it today on the program and also inviting you to have a conversation about this as well. The phone number is always 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. And we're going to be talking about Tiger Woods today, his confession or apology, and in particular, what he had to say about the Buddhist roots and foundations of his worldview. We'll be getting to that and hearing that portion of Tiger Woods' statement from Friday in just a moment. First, to review some other issues in the news, there is a report out that caught my attention immediately because it hits rather close to home. Jocelyn Novink, writing for the Associated Press, talks about a study that was done about how many electronic gadgets people are carrying around. Now, here's something that's interesting. It turns out that the group that is likely to have the most in terms of electronic gadgets, they're carrying around with them. They're in the backpack, in the briefcase, they're in the car, they're in the drawer, they're with these young adults all the time. These are young adults between the ages of 19 or 18 and 29. So it's 18 to 29-year-olds. They have an average of 4 electronic gadgets with them just about all the time. So when you see them and they're putting their bag in the locker, they got their backpack and they're cycling to class, you're talking 4 on average electronic gadgets they get with them just about the time you're looking at them there. Adults who are older, those between 30 and 64, well, they have on average just under 3. So you're talking about a cell phone and a PDA or a laptop and a cell phone or you name it that's adding up almost to 3, and teenagers, 3.5. So the average teenager, what's he taking to school, middle school or high school? What's he got with him just about all the time or her? 3.5 different electronic gadgets. Now, this is just a reminder to us that these technologies are, well, the sociologists use the word intrusive. They work their way into our lives in such a way that we can't imagine how we function without them. So we have a cell phone, we've got the laptop, we've got the PDA, perhaps the iPod or the game machine, whatever. They're with us all the time. Now, you know, this leads to some very interesting things that a lot of people may not have thought about. The average hotel room in America is over 20 years old. Those rooms were built without wiring, assuming that those who are going to be guests in those hotels are going to have to be recharging all of these things virtually all the time. You now go to airports, and at some gates, they actually have charging centers. You go and can see from place to place, you'll see where people are borrowing outlets just about wherever they can get them, because every one of these electronic gadgets demands to be fed electricity, and it's leading to some very interesting, new discoveries and new needs. If you're in a hotel room and you've got 4 or 5 things to charge, you only have one outlet, guess what? You got a challenge. I find that very interesting, just thinking about what that says about us, and not only about where we are now, but where we're going. I mean, after all, we're looking at the release of the Apple iPad coming in just a matter of a few weeks. How long will it be before that kind of pad computer or e-reader is also just about as common as the iPod and the cell phone and the laptop and the PDA? It's becoming increasingly so. Fascinating factoid, some new titles are selling in greater volume on Amazon.com in their Kindle ebook edition than in the hard printed codex, what you would call book edition. And that tells you something very significant as you look to the future. Tamar Lewin, writing in the New York Times, talks about a very different survey. This is a survey in which a large percentage of Americans indicate their dissatisfaction with the college and university system. In other words, with higher education. I have to tell you, I think I sympathize with this. I'm the president of a seminary and a college, and yet I understand what's going on here. We're undergoing a major transformation. I saw a study just in recent hours that suggested that the average family is going to find itself less and less able to send the average student to the average four-year undergraduate institution. So the average family, average student, average institution. The institution is becoming too expensive. The student is now uncertain of the absolute value of that college degree in terms of future earnings, and the parents are looking at their own experience and financial constriction. I want to tell you that's not all bad news, and hear this as one who is an educator. That's not all bad news. Christian parents in particular should be thinking very expansively about educational options for their young people, and the young people should be thinking the same. And by the way, if the educational establishment doesn't catch up, they're going to find themselves largely out of business. What we have to do is understand that there is an education that is available for just about every student, and it's an appropriate education. It may require something of a stretch, but it should not be a bank breaker. And I was talking to students just over the last few days, some of them telling me that as they were contemplating coming to graduate school, they were looking at the reality of having $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 in educational debt. Folks, that is a scandal. One of the hidden scandals in America today is how much educational debt a good number of students, graduates, and young adults are walking around with. Folks, from a great commission perspective, that really ties people down from their ability to go do great things for God, to be able to go and take a job, take a church, go to the mission fields, just do something great. Because after all, if you're spending a good percentage of your time repaying that educational debt, that means there are other things you are not doing. And by the way, this plays right into the delay of marriage, as there are many young couples and young people who are saying, look, I can't afford to get married. I'm walking around with this debt. Parents, please, if you don't hear anything else I say to you today, it is not necessary to pile up that kind of educational debt. That is a horrible decision. And if I can encourage any of you to look at other options, just understand that over the course of a lifetime, does an undergraduate degree make a difference? You bet it makes a difference. It makes a huge difference. It's not wrong when people say college is the new high school. In other words, it's the expectation. But over the course of a young person's life, the difference between going to this school or that school, well, if it means taking on a huge amount of debt, it's not going to be worth it. And I hope you hear it from me first. Interesting story out of Australia. David Nichols, a columnist there for The Age, the newspaper there in Melbourne, is writing what he considers to be an article of complaint against the people of Australia, the Australian government, and the Australian educational system for taking Christianity seriously. He points out that even as Australia has a traditional British history and influence in terms of colonization, he writes, fully 92% of Australians, quote, can't be bothered going to church. More than half of young people say they don't believe in God. And he says, therefore, the government in Australia needs to stop giving attention and deference to Christian churches and Christian convictions. This is really, really interesting, because what you're looking at here are some real debates on the ground that will make a difference. For instance, in Australia, the issue of euthanasia is being discussed. According to Mr. Nichols, writing for The Age, 80% of Australians favor voluntary euthanasia. However, the government doesn't bring it up because it is bowing to pressure from religious groups. You know, this is something that I raise for this singular purpose. Folks, if you want to understand why worldview matters, just look at this. If indeed Mr. Nichols is right, and considering he's writing as an unbeliever, I have to assume he believes his argument. If he says, indeed, that the one thing that is restraining Australia from the open embrace of euthanasia and assisted suicide is the residue of Christian conviction, that ought to tell you something. Worldview matters. It matters whether or not you believe that every single human being is an individual made in the image of God, or if you believe that at least some human lives are more expendable, that there is life not worthy of life, there is life that is not worthy of living. That worldview distinction is extremely important because, after all, we're talking here about a matter of life and death. A lot of worldview distinctions appear to be on a far less significant scale, but it always ends up right here. When you're making the big decisions of war and peace, the big decisions of life and death, the big decisions of medical ethics and economic and social justice ethics, this is where you find out that worldview really matters. An interesting testimony here from Australia, David Nichols saying, look, if 92% of Australians don't even go to church, why is it we care what Christian belief is on any subject, much less one that's a public controversy like voluntary euthanasia. Folks, he might win that argument, but in so doing, he really shows the importance of worldview. And that's why we're going to be talking about Tiger Woods. His Buddhist confession, was this America's Buddhist moment, an awakening into perhaps a new Buddhist future? Or is this an opportunity for us to look and say, wow, Christianity and Buddhism really are different when it comes down to even explaining the meaning of life and why something that's wrong is wrong? Get ready to give me a call at 877-893-8255, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're talking about Tiger Woods' Buddhist confession, and that's exactly how it's being characterized. Much of what Tiger Woods had to say on Friday was exactly what we have come to expect in terms of public apologies or public confessions. And by the way, he didn't actually apologize. He didn't ask for forgiveness. He asked for Americans to, quote, believe in me again. And that's going to be very, very interesting to see how America processes that. He did take responsibility for what he did. He used the kind of language that is very forthright. He said, the issue involved here was my repeated irresponsible behavior. I was unfaithful. I had affairs. I cheated. What I did was not acceptable, and I'm the only person to blame. Susan Wise Bauer, in her work, The Art of the Public Grovel, published just a couple of years ago by Princeton University Press, makes the point that we have now come to more or less expect a certain form to these public confessions, and she argues that it's a Christian form. And of course, since the majority culture in America has been shaped by the Christian conscience, that would make perfect sense. She goes so far as to root it in an Augustinian model, which is pointing to Augustine, or Augustine, as you may have heard his name, the great early church theologian. And he's the author of a book called Confessions, in which he actually goes through his life and tries to confess all his sins and talk about how indeed that the Lord's grace was operating in his life to show him his sin. And the very public nature of this kind of confession, well, it's central to Christianity. And it's, of course, something that bleeds over into secular culture, whether it's Jimmy Swaggart making his apology years ago or former President Bill Clinton. You know, you walk down scandal by scandal, individual by individual. It takes roughly the same form. And on Friday, Tiger Woods' statement took largely the same form, except for about one paragraph. And let's listen to this paragraph.
Part of following this path for me is Buddhism, which my mother taught me at a young age. People probably don't realize it, but I was raised a Buddhist, and I actively practiced my faith from childhood until I drifted away from it in recent years. Buddhism teaches that a craving for things outside ourselves causes an unhappy and pointless search for security. It teaches me to stop following every impulse and to learn restraint.
Every impulse, to stop following the impulses that, of course, led him into the behavior he described as unacceptable and unfaithful. But you notice when he talks about Buddhism and he talks about more or less reclaiming his Buddhist past, he said Buddhism teaches that a craving for things outside ourselves causes an unhappy and pointless search for security. Well, indeed, central to Buddhism, which, by the way, you could describe as a religion or describe as a faith because it is a worldview, but it doesn't require any belief in God whatsoever. It's not a theistic faith. It comes down to the Buddhist affirmation, the teaching of the Buddha himself, that the goal of our seeking should be to free ourselves of all desire, to renounce all desire. And as I point out in my article published this morning at albertmueller.com, the article is entitled Tiger Woods' Buddhist Confession. That is the opposite of Christianity. Christianity does not tell us that we are to renounce all desire. It tells us that God made us indeed to desire him. And that the problem from a Christian perspective is not desire, but the wrong kind of desire for the wrong things. There's a key worldview distinction, and it's something we really need to talk about. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Come from Columbus, Ohio, is Katie, listening on the World Wide Web. Katie, what are you thinking?
Well, first of all, I'm a Christian, and basically I saw the video of his confession, and I just don't think it's realistic to seek to be free of desires, and I think we should work on self-control. And I think we should use God to help us work on controlling things that we desire that are not good.
You know, Katie, that is just what we might call Christian common sense. In other words, you're reflecting an understanding of the gospel. You know, the whole idea of renouncing desire is so alien to most of us. And I think, nonetheless, there's an attraction to it that I want to go ahead and name and try to point to. I think there's a certain attraction to renouncing desire, at least because we know how surrounded we are by constant desires, and we tend to have a kind of moral reflex that tells us we would be superior people living a superior life if we did find a way to renounce certain of these desires, the desires fed by materialism and consumerism, the desires fed by money and lust and power. Yet at the same time, you know, ridding ourselves of all desire, renouncing ourselves of all desire appears, I think, very clearly to the Christian perspective to be making ourselves something less than human and what we were intended to be. And the human being, from a Christian biblical perspective, was actually made with certain desires. And those desires, by the way, are pretty good at getting our attention. Desires ranging from the desire to eat, the desire to drink, the desire to relate. There are sexual desires. There are desires of ambition. There are desires of meaning in our lives where we really desire to know that our life is significant. There are desires that are outside of us for things that are attractive to us. Some of those things are good, but some of those things are not. But I would suggest that ridding ourselves of desire is, number one, impossible. Now, several people have written a very clever response to my article this morning. They've read the article in which I compare and contrast Buddhism and Christianity, and Buddhism with its belief in a 12-fold chain of interlocking causes and effects leading to desire and the entrapment in desire, and how, you know, the Buddhist way of enlightenment is indeed to do what is necessary to renounce that desire. Contrasting that with Christianity, which says the problem is not the presence of desire, but wrongful desires for the wrong things that lead people to the wrong actions with the wrong attitudes to the wrong ends. But I point out that that the reality is that you really can't be free of desire no matter how much you want to be free of desire. And several people very cleverly have written, well, if you are to be free of all desire, how in the world are you going to be disciplined and committed to winning golf tournaments? Does Tiger Woods no longer desire to win a golf tournament? Does he no longer desire to be good at golf? Let me ask another question, and this, I think, gets to the very, well, interconundrum of Buddhism. How are you free from desire if you desire to be free from desire? In other words, you can't renounce desire without some desire to be even free from desire. I don't know about you, but that seems to me to be the kind of hole that once you just start digging, just gets deeper and deeper. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. In Louisville, Kentucky, Chris is listening on WFIA. What are you thinking, Chris?
Thanks for taking my call, Dr. Mueller. I think that what Tiger is saying is a lot more analogous to what the Ten Commandments would say about coveting. It's not that desire is bad. It's more like in the Ten Commandments where they say, do not covet thy neighbor's fill in the blank. What Tiger is saying and what Buddhism says is that unhealthy desires are destructive, just as the Ten Commandments says that coveting in an unhealthy way is bad. And he is not saying that all desire is bad any more than you can say the one cannot covet not coveting. So that circular loop you're creating, I think, is misplaced, sir.
Well, let me ask you, are you at all familiar with Buddhism? Because central to Buddhism is renouncing all desire.
I'm actually live with a Buddhist, and that's not true. It's okay to have desire. They're not saying that you have to live in a cave your whole life. What they're saying is exactly what the Ten Commandments says. Unhealthy coveting. Man.
Well, it's very interesting, and I think, quite honestly, this gets to the American tendency to create kind of our own adapted form of whatever, including Buddhism, and turn it into another consumer good. But, you know, if you're actually reading the Buddhist texts, it's hard to come up with what would be characterized as a good desire, which is why, by the way, the Buddhist idea of eternal blessedness is not at all the Christian understanding of heaven. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I appreciate Chris's call. And just to make certain, you know, when you're translating one worldview into a different cultural system, you always have to be careful that you're not getting it wrong. But as best as I can read the Buddhist texts, and there are different schools of Buddhism, but there's a central Buddhist, well, for lack of a better way of putting it, kind of a Buddhist orthodoxy. The second noble truth of Buddhism teaches that unhappiness in life and basically suffering are attributable to either desire or ignorance. And the problem is that I can't really identify any kind of appropriate desire in Buddhism. But Chris is certainly right. That doesn't mean that Buddhists do not eat and that they don't marry and they don't reproduce and do other things. But it does suggest Buddhism is very clear that it's a this worldly faith, this worldly worldview, in which we are not to assume that there are certain proper things we are to desire now that will only be compensated for in eternity. For instance, Buddhism suggests that immortality is one of the things that will never satisfy because it cannot be reached, and therefore it is a bad or wrongful desire that can only lead to unhappiness and suffering. So that, if you want to look at it at that level, is the key distinction, or at least a key an unmistakable distinction between Christianity and Buddhism, because Christianity really does say we live in a fallen world in which Christ is redeeming a people, but we are to understand that in this world we will never have our ultimate fulfillment. Our ultimate fulfillment is not something we are told not to desire, but rather it is to desire only in Christ, and will come only in the age that is to come. And to get back to the whole issue of desire, at the very least, we can say pointedly that Buddhism warns against the very desires that Christianity heightens and emphasizes. And this is one of the major problems in terms of this distinction, because when Tiger Woods gets up and makes that statement, clearly it's in the context of the fact that he desired many things he should not have. He desired many things that he now knows have led to his own suffering. But when he speaks very specifically, and in his own statement, he was very, very clear, when he says Buddhism teaches that a craving for things outside ourselves causes an unhappy and pointless search for security, well, he's pointing to, well, Buddhism as the distinction to his worldview that establishes the kind of path that he intends to take. I remember having a professor in a secular university years and years ago who said, if you don't understand the distinction between, for instance, Buddhism and Christianity, you don't understand why that for a Buddhist, the Christian understanding of heaven would turn out to be hell because of the heightened infinite state of desire that is both expected and fulfilled in the Christian understanding of heaven. The phone number to join the conversation, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Stephen Prothero, writing in USA Today, says that Tiger's confession on Friday was a Buddhist moment for America. Now, by the way, he's been on this program as a guest. He's written a great deal about the need for religious literacy in this country. And one of the things that he has forthcoming is a book on the eight basic religions. His book is entitled God Is Not One, the Eight Rival Religions That Run the World and Why Their Differences Matter. He's suggesting that Americans should not miss this opportunity to understand that there really are differences, that Buddhism is very different than Christianity, that even as Tiger's statement really did follow kind of the therapeutic construct we're familiar with in terms of these recent confessions after scandal, when it came to the larger issue of worldview, where he thinks forgiveness is rooted and what shape he thinks it would take, his statement really was distinctively Buddhist. Very interesting things, by the way. This is not the first time that Tiger Woods has spoken of his Buddhism. He spoke of it in interviews before, but no one really paid that much attention to it. They attributed it that more at the time to his famous discipline and concentration. I mean, after all, you're talking about an athlete who got to the very top of his field, understood that from the time he was extremely young, he was focusing on this one thing, a man of what was thought to be impeccable and almost unbelievable self-discipline. Now, when it comes to his recent scandal and admissions, it turns out that his self-control and self-discipline was not what it was thought to be. Nonetheless, he now claims that Buddhism will be a part of his way back, along with more treatment and more therapy, to use his words. Very, very interesting. I think that Stephen Prothero is right that a lot of Americans probably don't know what to do with this, because there is a relatively low level of religious literacy in this country. But I'll tell you, I think there are many Christians who, watching that, would be hard-pressed, regrettably and unfortunately so, to explain why Tiger's confession sounded strange to them. Join the discussion by calling 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're talking about Tiger Woods' Buddhist confession. Is it America's Buddhist moment? What do we learn from this? And what kind of conclusions should we draw about worldview? And when we look at Tiger Woods, we're seeing a man who is right now fighting a challenge that, most of us find absolutely shocking. Because what was revealed in the context of this scandal was a Tiger Woods that America didn't know. But as several sports writers and others have pointed out, we really didn't know much about him anyway. And so what we're learning about him is that Buddhism is very much a part of his life. And what his statement helps us to understand is some crucial distinction here between Buddhism and Christianity. The sum and substance of our conversation, I wrote about it today at albertmueller.com, an article entitled Tiger Woods' Buddhist Confession. We're talking about it here. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. Let's go to Holland, Massachusetts. Patrick is listening on WVNE. Go ahead, Patrick.
Good afternoon, Dr. Mueller. Thank you. It occurs to me that in Buddhist thought, there's an offense committed, but it's not against any particular person. There's no supreme moral authority, really, to which anybody has a right to appeal to in this case, other than a bunch of people in a supposedly tolerant society that have been quite intolerant of what he's done.
Yeah, you know, Patrick, there is something more to this in Buddhism, and that is karma. There is a moral principle or a moral judgment. You might even call it a moral law at work within the cosmos, according to the Buddhist worldview, that does bring about a certain judgment. But it's not a personal judgment by a personal judge, as is in Christianity. It's not a holy God who has been offended. It is rather a moral principle that has been broken. And in a world of fixed causes, there will be a cause and effect. And, of course, this has to do also with a cyclical understanding of time and history, a great wheel of history rather than a linear progression, which is so central to Christianity and, for that matter, to the Western worldview. And it also suggests that, in other words, punishment will come, but it may not even be in this life. It may be in a life to come in terms of an understanding of reincarnation. Appreciate the call, Patrick. Let's go to Anna calling from Johnson City, Tennessee. Go ahead, Anna.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. Thank you so much for taking my call. Just in response to what's happening with Tiger Woods, I think that this more importantly points to how much we need a redeemer, and left to our own vices, how doomed we are within and of ourselves, just destruction.
Anna, let me ask you a question. How do you know you need a redeemer?
How do I know?
Right.
I think, first of all, I am a believer, and creation points to just the groanings of redemption and how we're needing to be saved from ourselves.
Yeah, I think there are several things that come into play here, and that's why I asked the question. I think the Bible helps us to understand that there is a sense within every one of us that something is broken that must be fixed. In fact, there's a sense that something is wrong with us. And that's where the Christian understanding of conscience goes back to the Imago Dei, that is, the image of God in humanity. God planted a knowledge of himself within us so that we do, when we close our eyes and we listen to ourselves, when we're in a moment when we're involved in some kind of anguish or excitement or concern, we tend to know immediately that we are being judged. And we will be judged. We are being watched, You know, the old Christian formula is we know that we were known before we even know. And with that in mind, we understand that judgment is a very personal thing. We understand that God has planted within each one of us a witness to himself. Now, it's not a witness that is always reliable, because in a Genesis 3 world, unfortunately, our conscience can mislead us, but nonetheless, it's still there. And I think it cries out our need for a redeemer. We come to know that there is a problem that is immense and infinite and we cannot solve. And I think that's one of the ways that God prepares us to hear the gospel. But it is getting back to that basic distinction between Christianity and Buddhism to understand that if we think that the desire for wrong things is kind of the ultimate sin, you might say, or the ultimate cause of all suffering, then we can get out of this simply by renouncing the desire for the wrong things, or wrongful desire, and eventually, as we said, in some sense, renouncing all desire. The problem is, from the Christian perspective, that hardly solves the problem. Now, that becomes nothing more than a coping mechanism, because what we need is redemption. We don't need to find a way to be freed from this desire. We need to have this desire satisfied. Not always satisfied in the way that we might think it should be satisfied. That's why we don't invent our own gospel. Rather, as the scripture makes clear, God saves us from our sins in accordance with what brings him greatest glory. And that yearning within us for salvation, that yearning within us to be reconnected to our Creator, that yearning within us to be made whole, is actually something that is not to be renounced. It is indeed to be embraced. And as a matter of fact, when it comes to immortality, which again the Buddhists say is something that should not be sought because it isn't real, remember that in the book of Ecclesiastes we are told that God has planted within us a knowledge of eternity. And that's something that, again, marks a decided difference between Christianity and Buddhism. You know, obviously, as a Christian, my hope is that Tiger Woods would come to know salvation through Jesus Christ. I hope that rather than renouncing desire, there's a desire within Tiger that leads him to a receptivity to the gospel. But I also believe that this public occasion is a good opportunity for us to consider again what it means to hear something like what Tiger Woods said in his statement on Friday, and to do a worldview analysis of it, because we understand that ideas really do matter. Worldviews matter. Understandings of self and God and sin matter. Understandings of where we came from and what we believe the purpose of life is and where we're going, these matter. They don't just matter in a time of urgency and public scandal like Tiger Woods is having to deal with now. They matter at every moment of our lives because they determine how we live, how we make moral decisions, how we know what we believe is the good, the better, the best, or the bad and the worst. How do we understand how we find meaning in life in every single moment, whether it be standing atop the podium, getting a gold medal at the Olympics, or tending to a sick child? Regardless of what we're doing, the Christian worldview dignifies it as having eternal consequences. Worldviews matter. That's just so important, and a dispassionate worldview analysis is something that's nearly impossible to us because we are deeply embedded creatures in our own worldview. That's why looking at the contrast with other worldviews is not only a matter of good intellectual health, it's not only a matter of Christian apologetics, it's a matter of intellectual honesty, and that too is important. We're broadcasting today from Nashville, Tennessee. From coast to coast and around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back. A fascinating discussion about Tiger Woods' Buddhist confession. You'll find my article at www.albertmueller.com. It's good to be here in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks to Matt and Amber and the team here, because just always good to be here in Nashville and do the program from here in Music City. But it's also a good opportunity to kind of survey what's going on in worldview and why worldview matters. John DiIulio, you may remember that name. He was the first director of the White House Office on Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. He's a sociologist, and boy, he's a numbers guy. He crunches numbers all the time, and he's charts and graphs all over the place. But he also is able to make some arguments that are very interesting. And one of his arguments has to do with juvenile delinquency and juvenile crime. Now, those of you who perhaps are familiar with this data, you know that it's just inches and inches and piles and pounds of paper trying to come to terms with all of this. But he comes to one very clear understanding, and that is that there is a clear distinction between children, adolescents, who have a faith in God and a basic participation in going to church, and those who do not. Now, I'm just reading to you from his article in the Annual Review of Law and Social Science. He says there's a critical mass of evidence that diverse faith factors, believing in God, church-going, participation in a religious substance abuse program, ministries that mentor adjudicated youth and more, that these significantly reduce felonies and also other high-risk behaviors. Now, you could look at all kinds of questions that would come out of this. This is not pointing specifically at Christianity. It is pointing, however, nonetheless, at a key insight of the Christian worldview drawn from the Scripture, and that is that God made us as moral creatures, and it makes a great deal of difference to worldview whether or not we believe that our moral acts are meaningful and that we will be judged. You know, if you get a teenager and he does not believe in God and he does not believe in a divine judge and he doesn't believe that his acts can either be right or wrong judged by a holy God, well, he has significantly more moral elasticity for the kind of behavior that leads to high risk and to crime. But if you have a young person who believes in God and is taken to church to reinforce that and is reminded of the consequences of behavior and knows that morality is not just a matter of some kind of social construction, but he deeply believes that it's rooted in what is objectively right and objectively wrong, that teenager is much less likely to be involved in either high-risk behaviors or in crime. Now, you shouldn't have to have a PhD in sociology to figure that out, but it is interesting when a sociologist comes along to say, look, all the get-tough-on-crime stuff that was so popular in the 80s and the 90s turns out to have had far less of an impact than was hoped. The key to keeping teenagers out of jail is getting them in church. Build more churches, he says. Now, clearly, from a Christian perspective, there are a lot of questions to be answered there, but I will tell you this, it is a powerful affirmation of the fact that worldview matters. No one looking at that reality can argue otherwise, nor those who paid attention to our conversation today. I'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.